Hello, this time on SITREP, it's 75 years since NATO was created to defend Europe. We're going to be asking what's needed to do that job properly today, and it isn't just about missiles and tanks.
There's not enough rail cars to carry armored vehicles, or what we call HETs, the heavy equipment transports, the big trucks. There's not enough of these to move armored formations rapidly to a point of need.
One piece of the jigsaw, according to NATO, is its new Allied Reaction Force. It's meant to pack more punch and more quickly. We'll hear from the general leading the ARF, and Mike and I are joined by Ioana Lungescu, who spent more than a decade working side by side with the NATO Secretary General. Also on SITREP this week.
We were now rolling very, very violently either side. The damage control officer is reporting up to 12 different floods in different parts of the ship. And I've got in my ear the engineer saying, Abby Wood is suggesting we abandon ship. We're going to capsize.
Tom Sharp is the latest veteran to share their story in our series, The Moment That Made Me.
SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
Well, let's start with a quote from NATO's founding treaty. The parties are resolved to unite their efforts for collective defence and for the preservation of peace and security. Mike, those efforts are under some of the most intense scrutiny they've faced in the last 75 years, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And I think the dangers feel now the way they did when NATO was formed. I mean, when the treaty was first concluded, it was just a treaty and people thought, well, that's all well and good, so what? And then the Korean War broke out in 1950. And in those early years, those years after 1950 to 54, 55, it really felt to NATO as if the alliance would have to fight again in a rather Second World War style. And I have no hesitation in saying that the 2020s feel very like that period of the 1950s. NATO has never felt closer to having to either fight or be prepared to fight, to convince the opposition that it really can fight in a general European war. That's where we are today.
Well, as I mentioned at the start, Ioana Lungescu is with us, and she spent 13 years at NATO, a senior advisor to two secretary generals in that time, and she's now a distinguished fellow at the defence think tank, Lucy. Ioana, great to have you on SITREP. Good to see you again. To understand where we are now, it's worth looking back 10 years to when Russia first seized parts of Ukraine in 2014. How much has NATO adapted its ability to defend Europe since then?
So what's happened since the illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014 is that NATO has for the first time placed combat troops in the eastern part of the alliance, 8 battle groups from the Baltic to the Black Sea, and we have new members, 2 from the Western Balkans, Montenegro and North Macedonia, and very significantly Finland and Sweden. So basically doubling the border with Russia. So if Putin wanted less NATO, he actually has more NATO. And this is a stronger and a more robust NATO with more troops at higher readiness and learning the lessons also from the war in Ukraine.
So, Mike, a bigger team, but a bigger job.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, things are developing pretty quickly in NATO now. You know, remember, NATO is made up of the nations themselves. So NATO has to work with the individual defence policies that its members adopt. And although, you know, NATO officials and NATO generals can see what needs to be done, they can put it down, as they did in 2014. They a whole series of shopping lists of things. And by 2018, 2020, they ticked every box. But the question is, it's always a bit more slow and a bit more bureaucratic than we would like. So there's always this time lag. It's not that NATO isn't very good at evolving, but it evolves a bit more slowly than it does intellectually. Intellectually, it knows exactly what it needs. Practically, there's always a lag. We don't have a whole lot of time in order to put things in place for the mid-2020s, when a lot of people say we will reach a strategic moment in Europe. We don't know what it will be, so we're running out of time to implement properly all the things that we know need to be done and we talk about at summits.
Yeah, Mike is absolutely right that we don't have the luxury of time. A lot of good things have been decided. It's important that those things are implemented and that they've done so as a matter of urgency. We can't afford to wait and to see what Russia's next move is, what China's next move is. because we are in this for the long haul, and it looks like a very adversarial situation for a long time to come.
So, Mike, what do we need militarily in the next few years?
Well, the alliance needs to put this Eastern Shield, which is being talked about, I mean, which the Poland is very keen to create, which would be on 50 billion euros of EU money. But there's resistance in the EU to spending the money on that, not to doing it, but to spending EU money on that. But we need to do that. I think that the single most generic thing that NATO needs to do is, as I guess we're going to talk about, is to improve logistics internally. The size of forces that NATO's got on paper, but the difficulty of getting them in good order to where they need to go, that is pretty fundamental. And it's no good having good forces if they can't get there quickly. So deployability of our forces is probably the thing I would most want to see improvements on, while nations themselves build up more sustainable forces in what they've got on paper compared to what they can actually put into the field at short notice.
Well, the latest iteration of NATO's force model was agreed at the Madrid summit 2 years ago. At the very top of that model is a new Allied Reaction Force. It's described as the strategic, high-readiness, force-generated, multi-domain and multinational capability. And crucially, it can be deployed immediately on the orders of the Supreme Allied Commander Europe, rather than waiting for the approval of a multinational committee. The NATO Rapid Deployable Corps Italy will lead the ARF for the next 3 years under the command of Lieutenant General Lorenzo Daddario.
The new model is one where you have a very agile, joint and high readiness force that has in its component the span of capabilities that are required and the availability of SECUR, the Supreme Allied Commander, for strategic reserve, early insertions, and in order to add flexibility to the overall NATO response.
And this is the next iteration, I guess, of NATO's developing plans to be ready for whatever it.
Exactly. It's really to be ready for the expected and also to be ready for the unexpected, with a set of forces that can give, let's say, the flexibility to respond in a way that both at sea, in the air or inland is more attuned to the possible crisis or even conundrums that NATO might themselves find into.
Give us some potential examples. What range of tasks might this ARF be?
Yeah, the range of tasks is really very wide. It goes from traditional war fighting to also humanitarian disaster relief assistance and also non-combat evacuation operations, or indeed just reinforcement of ongoing operations. So it's a very wide range, and hence the flexibility and the possibility to deploy at very short notice.
I mean, that's key, isn't it, the short notice element of
it? It is very key. It is something that requires a lot of preparation. But I think it's not just the fact that we are preparing for short notice. It's the fact we're preparing with several nations. Namely, this year, the component of the land component will be British, 1st UK Division in York. And that adds, I think, to the complexity of the task, but also it's a very rewarding task because we do things together as we must be we must be able to do in NATO.
For those troops of 1st UK Division, you know, what's going to be required of them being in the ARF?
Well, being trained, being available, and that is a big demand of their families, on their organisations, of course, and there's a lot of commitment. It's the ability to get up and go at very short notice, which is something that your army practice, very often and generally across the board. And it's not just the army, it's navies and air forces. And indeed, these components rotate among nations and among services.
How short a notice is there a time set for?
Because it's very short and it's graduated, but across the board for this light force, and this is why it is light, it's got to be able to move fairly rapidly. You've got to have your kit in the backpack already.
How important is it that it's multi-domain?
It is very important because you really need, in order to have an advantage, you really need to move fast, but across all the various domains to gain superiority, to gain the upper hand. And therefore, if every area of combat supports the other, I think this is where the activities of the quarters and of the force are effective.
How busy do you think the ARF is going to be in the next few years?
Well, I think we're already quite busy. Luckily, we're busy training, but I think we stand ready to be busy. And it's all good.
That was Lieutenant General Lorenzo Daddario talking to SITREP's James Hirst. Well, part of the key here is the fact that Supreme Allied Commander Europe can deploy the ARF without referring up. Wanda, how much of a transfer of power is that exactly?
I think it's really important that General Cavoli, NATO Supreme Allied Commander Europe, has as many authorities as he needs. All the authorities, all the forces, all the capabilities at his disposal without necessarily always having to refer back to the North Atlantic Council. And that's actually happened already. It happened, and I remember it very well because I was there in the first hours after Russia's full-fledged invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February 22. There was a decision to activate the existing defense plans that NATO has, which are still extant, they're still in force, also giving SACA greater authorities. And that is the trend that we see now as NATO is starting to put in place this new family of plans, the regional plans. And the ARF, of course, is an important part of that. And it's connected to the plans. It also has a more consistent command with the NATO Rapid Deployable Corps in Italy, whose commander we've just heard, and it's multi-domain. So for the first time, it also includes not just cyber, but also space elements. And so it's at high readiness, a matter of days, 0 to 10 days, and it's able to move faster in greater numbers and with greater agility.
So, Mike, how much of a practical difference does it actually make to deployability, the ability to defend Europe?
Well, it might make a big difference in a crisis because historically, I mean, NATO gave the Supreme Commander very, very few troops, really just the headquarters troops that he could command, mainly because they didn't want an international general making decisions for national forces without consulting them. So the theory was that he would ask for contributions, the national forces would then be given to him, and he'd give them back to the national command authorities on the basis of the NATO plan. But SACA had very, very few troops of his own to command. That was okay in peacetime, but we're not really in that sort of situation now. So the idea that SACA can actually command a group of forces, a really rapid force that can address a crisis quickly, even though there's the political problem that can get you into difficulties if the national contingents don't follow up, that is regarded as a lesser threat than the threat of not being able to move quickly, because we know that things will happen very fast if they happen in a European conflict. And so this is a good move, I think, to streamline what would otherwise have been a rather elaborate choreography that NATO still has in theory, but this is knocking some of the corners off it.
Mm. Well, from the big picture of structuring hundreds of thousands of troops to the relatively small details like roads and bridges or ditches, which Latvia is digging on its border with Russia. Poland's also got a £2 billion project for a 430 miles of defences, including tank traps and barriers. Can they really make Europe better defended, or to coin a phrase, is it just taking a knife to a gunfight? Well, I've been talking to Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, the former commanding general of the US Army Europe.
I think these are important, but they're not standalone developments. They're important because it communicates to the Russians, but it also communicates to their own populations that, yes, there is a real threat and we have to take steps to prepare for it. But again, as we know from the sad history of the beginning of the Second World War, where the French had invested zillions of dollars into establishing the Maginot Line, most modern defenses anywhere. And of course, the German Wehrmacht was in a different operational plane in terms of how to fight against that. So our allies that are investing in these sort of defenses will need to make sure that the forces behind them are ready for the modern threat.
Are those border reinforcements much more than a gesture? Or do they provide any actual protection?
Well, sure. I mean, how did Russia stop Ukraine's assault? Stand fast the fact that, you know, we pushed Ukraine to launch their counteroffensive last year without the benefit of any air power and a lot of the things that we would have had ourselves. The fact is, they ran into old-fashioned trenches and minefields. So there is actual capability in those sorts of installations and defensive preparations. There is capability there, but we know that an obstacle that is not covered by observed fires, meaning direct fire or artillery or something, then they are really only hindrances versus being actual obstacles. So you have to have that combination. And it'll also be important. I mentioned the plans earlier. Sometimes people build obstacles, minefields, et cetera, without consideration for the actual operational plans of the higher headquarters. So this would need to be integrated as well.
So are those the kind of defenses you would like to see or you'd welcome along the whole border with Russia?
Only if they're backed up by capable, ready forces. I mean, it's not either or, but if I was forced to choose, I would rather have adequate combat power forces, air, land, and sea, at a high level of readiness, that have good maintenance, have plenty of ammunition, properly manned formations, well-trained. That's the priority. That's readiness. And again, this is not going to happen in just the land domain. The air power, the sea power of the alliance, as well as resilience of societies, you know, against cyber attack, against disinformation, all of this is just as important as having a million mines.
On the land domain, what about NATO's ability to move armor and people across Europe at speed? Are the roads and the rails up to the job?
No, they're not. We're still not there. It's better than it was when I was still in uniform. People after me have continued to improve that, but it's still a question. Part of it's the infrastructure. Part of it is capacity. There's not enough rail cars to carry armored vehicles or what we call HETs, the heavy equipment transports, the big trucks. There's not enough of these to move armored formations rapidly to a point of need. So there is a capacity shortfall still. But there's also, we still encounter issues about being able to cross borders. Again, it's much better than it was. The point is, now that we finally have a family of plans where SACUR can say, I need to have a certain type of capability in this area within a certain amount of days, then the nations can work to that requirement. We haven't had that in the past. And so I tell my friends in Lithuania, for example, and in Poland, I said, you should assume that you're going to be without external reinforcements and I say this to the Romanians as well, for up to 2 weeks. If we are caught by surprise, which should not happen, but it happens all the time, or political leaders are still just can't believe that the Russians would actually do something, It may be as long as 2 weeks before external forces begin to arrive. So whatever's in Estonia, which would of course include British forces and other allies that are part of the enhanced forward presence, that's it until other things begin to arrive. Same in Lithuania, where they'll have this huge German brigade and an American battalion. They're there, but there won't be Polish troops arriving immediately.
So what needs to happen to make those plans usable and effective?
You have to exercise over and over and over, as we did in the Cold War, where you could count on minimum once a month, if not more frequently, being called out to go to your general defense position. You knew every farmhouse. You knew exactly every where the wires were. I mean, you knew everything. You practice it over and over and over. That's what it takes now, I think, with these plans. You have to exercise to the point of failure. I mean, push, so you can discover where the gaps are in communications and logistics.
On the note of exercises, we've just had NATO's exercise Steadfast Defender across 5 months, involving more than 1,100 combat vehicles and 90,000 troops. How much will that have told the alliance and its militaries about its ability to defend Europe and where the weaknesses are?
I think it will have helped in several ways in terms of identifying and perhaps fixing some of the interoperability issues. I mean, how do you communicate with secure means to other countries that are not Five Eyes? So it's more difficult for sharing intelligence and connecting our networks. We will have confirmed or discovered those bridges and areas where that are not suitable for hundreds of armored vehicles, for example, to pass over them. I think it will have improved an overall appreciation for the logistics requirements. That my only complaint, or not a complaint, but a criticism will be that all of these movements would have been planned a year ago. So you could order the trains, you could get the permissions, you could do everything, which is as it is on big exercises. You can't just surprise the good people of Poland or Norway or wherever you're exercising. You can't just show up, although you have to practice that in pieces. And so I think there's not a lot of failures involved in these big exercises. And I think you have to exercise also to the point of failure, especially when it comes to the air and missile defense. So the big exercises would not have pushed our air and missile defense capabilities very hard.
Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the privilege, Kate.
And Mike, only so much you can do in exercising, testing to break points. How could that be done more?
Well, as Ben Hodges said, you just got to do more of it. And all exercises are artificial, some more artificial than others. And you've just got to sort of get out of the system all of those things that are easy to, where you take the line of least resistance. You know, the most famous example of this is the Russian one in 2022, when Russian forces built up 190,000 around the Ukrainian border. They're all told they're on exercise until 3 days before they invaded. And suddenly they found they didn't have enough fuel. They'd said they had ammunition that they didn't have. They'd flogged all their radios. The local troops had basically sold everything that would move inside their vehicles. And they were completely and utterly unprepared, because on exercises, they don't take it very seriously. That's the problem. Now, we're not nearly as bad as that. But that tendency not to take it too seriously. You know you're going to be there for 2 weeks, then you'll be back. You say things are fine, when actually, if you push them, they're not really fine.
Well, now, how does NATO actually learn the lessons from something like Steadfast Defender? What is the process exactly?
Well, obviously, NATO, like every military, has its own lessons learned process. The problem is that sometimes you identify the lessons, but you don't necessarily learn them. So I think the whole point is, how do you go from identifying them to learning them and doing so in a systematic way and very quickly, because again, we don't have the luxury of time. I think Steadfast Defender, as you mentioned, with 90,000 troops, was the biggest NATO exercise since the Cold War, and that is already saying something. And it was very deliberately designed to test the new family of plans, the new regional plans. So you have now a much greater connectivity between the plans, the exercises, and the capabilities that allies need to provide. So it's not just randomly assigning capability requirements, it's much more integrated with the exercises and with the plans. So it's the plans driving everything. In terms of Steadfast Defender, I think obviously interoperability and reinforcement across the Atlantic and within Europe was a very important part of that. It's also significant that we saw NATO's new logistics command, JSEC, which has been in place since 2018, taking direct oversight of coordinating one part of Steadfast Defender, the movement of multinational troops through Germany to Poland and beyond, and then back home. So exercising those border crossings, exercising crossing the infrastructure, using the infrastructure, and other elements that I think were fairly new in Steadfast Defender is the use of drones, learning lessons from the war in Ukraine, and also more decentralized command and control. But I think in terms of the infrastructure, logistics, military mobility, the sort of things that General Hodges was talking about, NATO, of course, has been working on this since 2014, but there are limits to how much NATO can do. A lot of it has to do by the nations themselves, and you already see host nations of the multinational battle groups like the Baltics and Poland investing, and Romania investing much more in the local infrastructure, making sure that the bases are there to, if needed, reinforce the battle groups up to brigade level. And you know, those buildings and those facilities will not turn up overnight. But then, of course, the EU also has an important role in helping invest more in the infrastructure, the right-sized bridges, the railways, and there has to be, again, as General Hodges was saying, greater coordination between governments and authorities and the private sector. Because, of course, most of the infrastructure, the rail cars, are not state-owned anymore as they used to be during the Cold War.
Well, we focus on land, but we should talk about other domains. General Ben, like many others, raises real concerns about NATO's air defence. Juana, if we go back to the 2010 NATO summit, there were grand plans for a missile defence shield. Has anything ever come of that?
Yes, of course. There is a missile defence shield in Romania. There's work in Poland as well. But of course, in a way, the situation has changed because the missile defence shield that was agreed in 2010, and where, by the way, the offer was also there for Russia to work together with NATO on that missile defence shield, because the assumption was that it was to counter threats coming from outside the Euro-Atlantic area, basically Iran. Of course, the Iranian threat is still there. However, I think now the air and missile defense system that NATO has needs to be much more focused on the threat coming from Russia. And we still don't have all the capabilities we need. However, I think the fact that allies have been acquiring fifth generation fighter jets, the F-35s in particular, but also acquiring a whole lot of other capabilities like Patriots, are helping mitigate some of those gaps, but much more needs to be done when it comes to air and missile defence.
And Mike, ultimately NATO is a cooperative of countries who all contribute by running their own defences. Is air defence something that can be best coordinated and driven across NATO, or does each country know its own needs best?
Well, if we're talking about ground-based air defence, I mean, that's a mixture of a country's own contributions and what NATO may do more jointly. But in the air operations in general, NATO is in very good shape, really. Our air power in NATO is very strong, and it's well coordinated through the CAOC, you know, the Combined Air Operations Centres. So there's a northern CAOC in Germany, there's a southern CAOC in Spain that look after, and they monitor something like 30,000, 35,000 air movements every day. And then there's a deployable centre in Italy, which can be sent anywhere else. So NATO is actually in good shape when it comes to air power, and quite a lot of air defence would rest on its air power as well as its ground-based air defences. So that picture is not as bad, or is not as worrying as some other aspects of NATO. It is one of the strengths, and I think, and it's very well coordinated. And again, you know, NATO pilots are so much better, as they were trained in coordination, than what we've seen of Russian pilots in the Ukrainian war. We do really have integrated air defence and air power to offer, and I'm quite encouraged by that.
Werner, how well set up is NATO for naval operations? Are there gaps that are now clear given what we've seen in Ukraine?
I think in terms of naval operations, since Russia's full-fledged invasion of Ukraine, we've actually seen a fairly positive ratio of about 3-1 between NATO and Russian naval assets. So from that point of view, I think we've also seen a lot of significant exercises. Aircraft carriers, including the French aircraft carrier, for the first time put under NATO command and control. The same thing with American aircraft carriers. So we've seen a very strong effort by SHAPE, but also MARCOM, of course, the Maritime Command based in Northwood, UK.
A final thought from both of you. If there is one thing that NATO could do at the upcoming summit to improve defence of Europe, what would it be?
I think it would be something more generic in a way. That if what came out of this NATO summit was more practical help for Ukraine, not membership is off the table for now, but you know the route to membership is certainly there. But this summit needs to convince the Russians that NATO is not going to give up. And it can say it won't give up, but it's got to do things to indicate that it won't. So the best thing for European defence at the moment is to help Ukraine to prevail in the war it is now fighting for its own survival. That's the single biggest issue for the rest of us.
I agree with Mike that support for Ukraine will be uppermost. And of course, NATO will take a much greater role in coordinating security assistance and training for Ukraine. But I would say that the bigger political message that the summit sends, a message of unity, of strength, of readiness, will be the most important one, because, of course, this will be a message. This will be a message and a summit that will be watched not only by allied nations and populations, but also by Russia and China and others around the world very closely.
Juana Lungesco, so good to have you on SITREP. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, to finish this week, another inspirational military story in our series, The Moment That Made Me. This time it comes from Tom Sharp. We've spoken to him many times on SITREP for insights into naval operations from his two decades with the senior service, but we've not really heard much about that career before now. Tom says the moment that made him came in December 2008 when he was second in command of the icebreaker HMS Endurance. With the captain away, Tom was in temporary command as the ship sailed from South Georgia through the Magellan Strait across the southern tip of Chile.
I'd gone down to my cabin to make a cup of tea when there was a pipe in the engine room. There was a casualty and then there was a flood in the engine room. I went up to the bridge, straight up to the bridge to see what was going on. I looked at the cameras to my left and I saw water coming in at a rate that made me immediately think, if we don't stop this, we're going to sink. We put out a mayday on channel 16, the emergency channel, and nobody answered because of where we were in the world. And that was the moment I realized this. We had to stop this ship from sinking. We had to stop it from capsizing. And we were the only ones that were going to be able to do it. So my first thought was, what's caused this? And therefore, can we stop it? It's very obvious that we had no pumps or anything that was going to be able to deal with this. We needed to stop it at source. I remember very clearly that the whole team on the bridge stopped talking when I appeared, and they all looked at me. Now, we hadn't taken the ship to emergency stations at that point, which is a kind of default setting when something like this happens. So I was able to, in the calmest voice I could muster, order the ship to emergency stations, which was great because it elicited a whole series of reactions, one of which was for everyone to stop staring at me and get back to their business. But they're right on hand with the two people that I needed. I needed the engineer because I needed to try and find out what had happened. And I needed the logistics officer because she was now in command of the flooding and the developing situation, working out from the scene what's happening and what's our best way to counter that. So the expertise I needed in those first 80 seconds was right there already on the bridge.
And what had happened? What had caused the valve to fail?
We were doing some work on a seawater inlet valve. We'd been struggling to make enough fresh water for the ship. And the engineers had gone to clean a strainer on this valve, essentially whilst there's this long legacy and list of reasons why we got to that point in time. On the day itself, there was some poor engineering work that went on that led to this incident.
So there you are, the water's pouring in, your ship is in danger of sinking. Can you talk me through how events unfolded?
Yeah, so once I'd set in train this emergency stations thing, a few things leapt straight to mind. The first and most obvious was that we were going to lose all propulsion. The engine room was filling up. I could see the people in there already up to their knees. I reckon we had probably 6 to 10 minutes maximum where we could still drive the ship below. So my immediate thought is, what do I do with the ship? I went to the chart to see if there was somewhere we could deliberately run the ship aground, which is an extraordinary thing, really, when you consider I've spent my entire career training to avoid doing this. I'm now looking for an opportunity to do it deliberately, because that seemed to me like a good option to stop the ship from sinking. But where we were in the Western Magellan Straits, and it's like Norway, you know, it's vertical. So there was nothing. So at that point, my best option is to turn the ship into wind, increase to about 6 knots. I didn't want to go too fast in case this was a gash in the side of the ship, and I still didn't know that. But go to 6 knots and keep one engine running for as long as I can, because I know that as soon as that we lose propulsion, the ship will turn beam onto the sea and we'll head back downwind. So we need to buy ourselves as much drifting time as possible. So that was sort of item one. The second one was what to do with the helicopters. We had one that was turning and burning on deck, was about to take off. So we shut that one down and then get a message to the helicopter that's in Punta that's just lifted off and is coming back to us, and tell that to turn around, and all the while trying to work out what on earth has just happened to the ship.
And how was everyone involved in trying to save the ship? Because I understand you had students on board as well.
We had 18 to 21-year-olds who had come to us to learn leadership. In some deeply ironic fashion, we'd had them with us in South Georgia, and they'd done bits of the Shackleton War, and they were a great bunch of kids. But they were now in the wardroom when this was all unfolded, and I had to go and see them to try and explain what was going on. And I saw a lot of fear and a lot of kind of confusion as to how we could be in this situation in a British warship, and I really felt that. And trying to reassure them when at that point in time I was not reassured, wasn't a huge amount of fun.
And they ended up helping as well.
Yeah, they did. They were brilliant. Once we started to develop a semblance of control, so maybe an hour in, 2 hours in, then yes, we were able to use them in human chains with buckets and bailing out, and they got stuck in just like everyone else. It was kind of hard to see. And I'm still in touch with a few of them now, which is lovely.
At any point, did you actually really think, I'm going to lose this ship?
Yeah, those first 30 seconds, that was my initial reaction. And there were other moments. I mean, we were getting stability advice from ashore. As the engine room got more and more flooded and we lost propulsion, as predicted, and we turned beam onto the sea, we were now rolling very, very violently either side. I can see from other cameras that the water is through the ship. The damage control officer is reporting up to 12 different floods in different parts of the ship. And I've got in my ear the engineer saying, Abby Wood is suggesting we abandon ship, we're going to capsize.
Oh, why didn't you?
I'd spent a lot of time at sea by that point. And I'd spent a lot of time at sea in command of small ships, whose job it was to stop in the water. And that sounds sort of slightly trite, but in my mind, we weren't going to capsize. Now, of course, that's a big call, because who's to say? The other problem I had was how to get off the ship. That was not going to be easy. We had those inflatable tubes that go down the side of either side of the ship, and the life rafts inflate at the bottom of them. They look amazing when you test them in harbour, but they're not much use in anything above a sea state 3 or 4, and we were way above that. So how are we going to get into these life rafts? And then even if we do successfully get in, how do we keep ourselves safe once in them? Because there's rocks everywhere. And then I added that to my sort of general sense that we were already in the best life raft we had, and I stayed put.
And thankfully, you were right. How did you get out of that situation?
We then sat there for overnight. Meanwhile, one of the salvage tugs is coming at full speed from Fuzarains. There was a little bit of drama involved there, but they got us in tow. And before you know it, we're heading inland. We're in the much calmer waters of the narrow Regellan. And we're towed for 24 hours alongside Fuzarains.
And the biggest sigh of relief, I bet, of your life. This was the moment that made you. You were only 36 at the time, Tom. How did that moment make you, and how have you drawn on that experience in later life?
It gave me the confidence to realise that I can tackle pretty much anything. You know, I've got the basic skill set to be able to lead tackle extreme situations. When I went to my frigate after this, so I went and commanded the frigate after the icebreaker. I actually had to be slightly careful to almost sort of park it. I didn't want it to define me in that job. I didn't want to suddenly become a risk-averse captain. I didn't want to give my engineering officer a hard time for, you know, for fear of this happening again. I wanted to let them run their business, and I wanted to carry on being, you know, sort of the CEO that I was. So in a way, I had to suppress it a little bit. But thereafter, you know, it was just tremendously reassuring to know that I had that in my toolbox, the ability to deal with extreme jeopardy and manage it in a fairly sort of controlled manner.
Tom Sharp, it's been such a privilege to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us and in so much detail. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mike, when I was talking to Tom, one of the things that I found really interesting about what he was saying was that there were people in that situation where they're under such intense pressure that really stepped up, that he hadn't even expected, that they were almost like the stars that kind of stepped up to the plate. And it kind of really underlines the importance of knowing your team, knowing your people, so you can deal with that kind of a crisis.
Yeah. When you're running anything, there's always that sense of when you've got a crisis, there's certain people you're glad to see them around. Somebody walks into the room and goes, oh, I'm glad you're here. The people you want with you in a crisis. And sometimes they're not the people you would normally expect. And the other thing that strikes me about Tom Sharp as a seafarer, he's in very good company in terms of English seafarers. The most famous English seafarer, Francis Drake, went through the Magellan Strait, first man to circumnavigate the world. And at that time, he took three ships into the Magellan Strait, lost two of them. And with all hands, one of them turned back, the other one was lost with all hands. And he carried on in the Golden Hind and went through to the Pacific. And in those days, we're talking here about 1578, it was believed that the Magellan Strait was a one-way trip. The Atlantic swells and the wind meant that if you went through it, you couldn't get back through it. And so Drake found himself in the Pacific. He looked for a northwest passage to see if he could get back into the Atlantic. In the Arctic, went up north of Vancouver and couldn't, of course, because the northwest passage didn't exist. And so that's why Francis Drake had to circumnavigate the world. There was no other way of getting from the Pacific back home except keeping on sailing westwards, because nobody knew that you could go both ways through the Magellan Strait. It was so fierce. It was so ferocious. And I think Tom Sharp is in very good company there in terms of English seamen.
Extraordinary, Mike. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of our guests. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, you can always catch up with past programmes at bfbs.com/SITREP, the Forces News YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.